Good evening, Mr. and Mrs. America, and all ships at sea. It's time for Jack Mangan's Deadpan. I am your host, Jack Mangan, a.k.a. V'ger. So first we had the slush god, then we had the creative guy, and now our third editor guest on Deadpan is Ellen Datlow. She's had a great long career right at the pinnacle of science fiction short story publishing, and it's an honor to have her on. Other business matters. First off, I want to say thank you very much to Dr. EJ for his PayPal donation. Thank you, Dr. EJ. If you out there would like to donate some money towards the Deadpan cause, there's a button on the right sidebar at www.jackmangan.com. And that's it. Thus endeth the intro babble.
My name is Ascana Moldarin, first queen of the throne of a thousand suns. I lead my people on the dawn of a new age, but have discovered hidden traitors already at work to destroy everything I have won. In this time, when my kingdom hangs in the balance, my only ally is a pirate from a far-off land called England.
Well met, Your Grace.
Goddess, protect him from my wrath. Merevi, The Chronicles of Rafe and Ascana, written by T. Morris and Lisa Lee. Available now at Podiobooks.com. Experience the epic fantasy, SFF Audio Calls, a richly inspired whirlwind romance, swashbuckling action, Takes the Main, and heart-rending romance, builds slowly, culminating right to the end.
What would you do without me, Your Grace?
Challenge me again, privateer, and we may find out. Merevi, The Chronicles of Rafe and Ascana. Subscribe now at podiobooks.com and embark on a grand adventure.
Quick plug for those guys. You heard Karen from California, who has her Bunkcast launched. And also, that's obviously for T. Morris, who's a great friend of the Deadpan. And you know what? There is a team in T. Morris. I'll give you a second to stop laughing. All right. Now for Dumbass Memories.
Dumbass Memories.
So this is a Dumbass Memory double shot of a sort. The first one is actually from me. And it's one that you may have even heard yourself. And no, not the goddamn Winging It pool party. Although it does involve Michael and Evo's Winging It podcast. See, I was there subbing in for Evo this past weekend when Michael started to prep for the haiku moment segment. But then he realized he didn't have any more haikus. By the way, I don't remember who contributed those, but I was definitely a fan. Good stuff. So I said to Mike, hey, hold on, I'll write you up a haiku really fast. Now you know the rules of the haiku form. The first line must have 5 syllables, the second must have 7, the third must have 5 syllables again. So, I wrote something that adhered perfectly to the format. Cool. But then when Mike said, okay, let's record it, my fuzzy brain read the first line and only counted 4 syllables. So I inserted the word old into line 1 and recorded. If you heard Winging It, you heard it. The first line was this. Mark Hamill's old movies. Yep. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. This didn't occur to me until later on, however, when I had sobered up and was driving home. By adding the word old, I'd screwed up my haiku. Now the haiku should read as follows. Mark Hamill's movies. What the hell was he thinking? Except for Star Wars. But hey, you know what? No one else seemed to notice it, so I probably should have just kept my mouth shut and not made it a dumbass memory. But you know what? If you got beef with it, then I have 2 words for you. Poor counting skills. Alright, let's get on to a really funny dumbass memory from James in London.
Hey Jack, this is James in London, and I wanted to submit my own dumbass memory to the panel. This is a memory of deadpan delivery, specifically to my younger sister. It happened, I guess, about 15 years ago, so I would have been about 10 or so, and a couple of years younger than that. I say deadpan delivery because I used to delight in winding my sister up, trying to get her to believe some absurd things. In particular, it was the summer I managed to convince her that freckles were contagious, and that I really could wipe my freckles onto her face. Em couldn't stand freckles and never used to get them, but thanks to a dose of deadpan, I spent a good few hours that summer tormenting her and chasing around the garden with her close to tears. Curiously enough, that summer was the only time she actually did get freckles. Em's now all grown up and has taken to doing a spot of modelling, so of course she's not nearly so susceptible to my bullshit-ish. Okay, I guess I did keep a straight face a year or so ago while convincing her that the reason that models were reputedly not so bright was that the photographer's flashes were so powerful the light entered in through the model's eyes and actually burned their brain cells a bunch at a time. Keeping it deadpan, this is James in London with my dumbass memory.
Dumbass memories.
Straight out of the 60s, it's the Magical Mystery Trek, featuring John Lennon as Kirk, Dr. Bones McCartney, George Harrison as the level-headed, logical Mr. Spock, and Ringo as the red-shirted yeoman. Join them on their long and winding road across the universe, the final frontier. Spock's bowl haircut finally makes sense. So don't you go carrying pictures of Klingon Chang. Come together and watch. You'll want to see it 8 star dates a week. Hear Paul say, "Damn it, Jim, I am the walrus, not a doctor." Play the episodes in reverse to get the backward messages. See Phil Spector sometimes show up as Scotty the Engineer. Don't miss when the evil screeching Yoko alien comes in, destroys the ship, and breaks up the crew after only 78 episodes. Or watch Julian and Sean Lennon in The Next Generation, if for no other reason than to see Sergeant Riker's Lonely Quarks Club Band. Romulan Wood, isn't it good? Hey, it's that or watch reruns of The Monkeys Lost in Space.
Danger, Mickey Dolan's danger.
Maggots, wipe that stupid grin off your faces and listen up. This is Deadpan.
So, Deadpan listeners, for those of you familiar with the science fiction literature, then you must have come across at some point something that this woman has had her hands on. This is Ellen Datlow, who's the esteemed editor formerly of Sci-Fiction and Omni Magazine, and we're really proud to have you on the Deadpan Podcast. Thanks, Ellen.
Thank you. Thank you for having me here.
Yeah, it's a pleasure's all mine. So now let's talk a little bit about your role for the past, 25 or so years, your role in the science fiction community.
I guess since Omni, at least. That's about 25 years. As scary as it sounds.
Well, yeah, that means you've definitely had a major influence on the last 25 years of science fiction, you know, being part of these major short fiction markets and these major short fiction anthologies.
Well, I'm not sure if I should thank you or cringe. You know, I don't know. I guess I have. I think co-editing the years of fantasy and horror, I think I've had more of an influence on, at least I hope, of spreading the word about good horror stories for the last 20 years.
Well, yeah, that's true, right? And you're right, I neglected to bring that up. You don't only have your hands in science fiction, but right, you also have the notable horror, best of the year horror anthologies.
Mm-hmm.
Now,
and also fantasy. I mean, I edited a fantasy anthology that in all the places I've worked, in Omni, at Event Horizon, which I ran for a year and a half, and Sci Fiction, I've always published science fiction, fantasy, and horror short fiction.
Right, okay, yeah. We authors always like to blur the genre lines anyway and never like to say, well, my story is straight up in this genre and that's it. So I think speculative fiction all does tend to blend together anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, fantastic. I think fantastic fiction can actually include everything there, or the fantastic and the grotesque that covers science fiction, fantasy, and horror, if that's okay with you.
Yeah, I can live with that. Yeah, Yeah, again, you know, the labels, you know, you don't really think as you're writing it, unless you're being paid to think that way. You don't really think, okay, this is science fiction, and therefore there will be zap guns and spaceships and aliens.
No, I mean, I think the best writers do just write what they want to, and then, you know, the best way to do it is find the market afterwards.
Right. Yeah, I totally agree. Now, since you got into this, like you said, you started Omni in 81. Now, for you, was it a love of just fiction and writing in general, or was it more about your love of speculative fiction?
Well, I originally actually got into book publishing in the mid-70s, and I was in mainstream trade book publishing, which means just mainstream, like hardcovers. I've always loved science fiction, fantasy, and horror, and I've always loved short stories. I've read them since while I was growing up. But my first jobs were with book publishers, and mostly as editorial assistants. I didn't really get very far. But even while I was working with mainstream fiction, I still read science fiction, fantasy, and horror. My first job in the actual field was at Omni. But okay. Before I worked at Omni, I did reading. I did slush reading. Well, I guess it was not exactly slush reading, but I read manuscripts for freelance for Dell Books, for Ace Books, and for Science Fiction Book Club, and for 20th Century Fox in the mid-70s, mid to late 70s. That was while I was still working in book publishing. Because I kind of wanted to get my hand back into science fiction and fantasy. The reason I didn't go into it immediately was I didn't want to be pigeonholed, and at the time there weren't that many original books being published. A lot of the science fiction books were reprints. So most of the big publishers had reprint lines, and they were reprinting. A lot of them were reprinting serials from the magazines and things like that. That's kind of why I didn't go into science fiction initially. Although I have to admit, I never knew that the magazines existed when I was growing up. I read a lot of the Best of the Year anthologies in the 70s, and I also read Dangerous Visions and again Dangerous Visions. And a lot of anthologies from England, the Carnell anthologies. And I didn't realize that some of those stories came from magazines. Not Dangerous Visions, and again Dangerous Visions, but certainly the Year's Best.
Okay.
I had no idea that there was such a thing as a magazine that had science fiction.
Oh, that's interesting.
It came at it from a different way than a lot of other editors did.
Sure, yeah, that's definitely... But it does seem that the interest in short fiction was always there.
Absolutely. I mean, I was reading... When I was a kid, I was reading Bullfinch's Mythology, Guy de Maupassant, Nathaniel Hawthorne, Edgar Allan Poe. Yeah, that's
sure.
What I was reading when I was growing up, and my parents had... And then Bradbury and Ellison. I mean, I loved short stories. I always did.
Okay, yeah, I mean, that's obviously... And that's shown through, obviously, throughout your career. And now... I guess this is deviating a little bit, but you do still read novels, and what do you think?
I don't have much time to read novels because I'm reading so much for the Year's Best. I mean, I'm constantly reading short fiction, short horror fiction. I really don't have... I rarely read more than 3 or 4 novels a year in the field. I've just read Monster Island, which was a zombie novel by David Wellington. I think it's the first novel. It was pretty good. But I read a James Lee Burke novel, but I hardly ever have time to read novels. I'm just usually reading collections, anthologies, and magazines, or else reading submissions for various anthologies.
Okay. And I guess then that would mean that everything you're reading now is within the genres. It's, you're not reading much mainstream at all anymore.
Pretty much, yeah. I mean, you know, once in a while, as I said, I picked up a James Lee Burke book. I actually was on a plane home from Australia, and I read that. I loved most of James Lee Burke, although I wasn't wild about the last book. When I'm not reading in the field, I'll sometimes read crime books. I like certain crime books. For a while, I really liked serial killer books, but I kind of got sick of them after, you know, in the mid-90s, they were all over the place.
Yeah, the post-Silence of the Lambs, yeah, that was everywhere.
Yeah. But even now, I mean, there's still some good ones being published. It's just that I kind of lost interest in seeking them out. You know, it's like, I mean, because my novel reading is so intermittent, I really have to choose something that I absolutely want to read. I just started a book called The Stone Ship that was recommended by a couple of people. It's an Australian book. And I don't even know when I'll get to finish it. And I picked it up and I read like 30 pages. And basically, I'll take it with me when I go visit my parents on Sunday, you know, and have a long train ride. But generally, you know, I don't have time for novels.
Okay. And then now, so with the loss of sci fiction, with the, you know, which was, I mean, feel free to vent about that or complain about that if you want.
Well, there's nothing really to say. I mean, we lasted about 6 years. We did very well, and we got a lot of awards. And the people who sponsored us, I mean, you know, it was basically sci-fi.com, which is a web presence of Sci-Fi Channel. The marketing people decided that it wasn't, that publishing fiction wasn't pushing, it wasn't in line with what the website became, which is basically to push the on-air material. You know, when I was hired, they were expanding. It was sold by three times while I was working there. And when I started, it was beginning to expand content, and the content got really important. Powers that be wanted the site to be everything for science fiction readers, fans, and everybody, and they wanted it to be the major site for science fiction. But then gradually over time, after it was bought twice, the thrust of the site was different. And basically now the only original material is Sci-Fi Wire, which is news, is SF Weekly, which has reviews and things like that. And I think there's a new tech section. So, I mean, there are little bits of things, but not major content. There used to be audio drama. There used to be animation. There used to be videos. And now everything has to push towards the Sci-Fi Channel. So, you know, I mean, it was an understandable change because the whole idea behind the site changed.
I see. Well, at least you do have those years, I mean, to be very proud of. Or, I mean, it was very esteemed. It was very held. It was held in such high esteem, sci fiction. It was really a great thing.
It was a great gig. I had a great time doing it. You know, I was able to do anything I wanted, and that was really nice for a change.
That's cool.
I mean, usually when you have a boss, you do have rules as to what you should or should not publish. But I was pretty much left alone. And for the first time, I was able to publish novellas, which was great. I published some novellas when I was when Omni Online first started, before it really got onto the internet. Mm-hmm. You know, right between the transition between Omni Print and Omni Online, we published a few novellas on AOL. And they were sponsored by a car. I forget which car it was, Ford or someone, and they paid a lot of money, and we were able to, you know, commission like six novellas. But generally, you know, I've never in print. I was never able to run novellas because I never had the room. So that was the wonderful part about the website, about the web, that you have plenty of room to do whatever you want.
Yeah. So since sci fiction is in the past now, unfortunately, I mean, what are you working on now, and what can we look forward to in the near future from you?
Well, I've been working on anthologies. I've handed in several original anthologies. Of course, I'm always doing the year's best. Terry Winling stopped doing the year's best a couple of years ago because she wanted to write more. And believe me, every year around March, I'm totally burned out and thinking, I could quit. I could stop doing this. And then I think, no, I can do it another year. but I've handed it. Terry Winling and I are doing some anthologies together. I have some solo anthologies, and I'm hoping to get more contracts for more original anthologies. And right now, I'm doing fine. I'm doing exactly what I want to do. Whether I can afford to do exactly what I want to do, which is edit short fiction, without a full time gig, I don't know. You know, I'm also guest editing an issue of Subterranean magazine.
Okay.
But that's just a one shot deal.
I see. So your ideal then would be to get a full time something like sci fiction again. That's what you'd prefer.
If I could, well, my ideal is to be able to edit enough original anthologies that I can make a living at it. You know, but I don't think that's going to happen. But you never know. I mean,
okay.
I have, you know, we'll see. But yeah, the problem is, of course, there are very few short story magazines or webzines that pay. Many of the small press magazines don't have professional editors. I'm an editor, and that's all I do. I don't do anything else. You know, that's my full-time job, and that's my profession. It's not like I can do editing as a hobby. You know, I can't do anything else. So if someone's going to if someone has to hire me, I'm not going to volunteer to edit things.
Sure.
So that's the issue, really. And, you know, unless someone creates this job for me, I don't see. There's no room. I mean, there never has been. I mean, after Omni closed, my colleagues and I started Event Horizon and made that go for a year and a half, but it didn't last because we had hoped when we started, we hoped that it could brand our web, a web work. We were planning on doing some, you know, we actually organized a few online conventions for EOS, with Avon, now Harper EOS. I don't even know what it's called anymore, HarperCollins EOS.
Okay.
And we ran like two or three EOS cons, online conventions. But basically the web work didn't pay enough so that we could do a magazine. And just at the time when we pulled the plug on that, I was approached by sci-fi.com and they created this job for me to work at Sci Fiction, what we named it, Sci Fiction.
Okay.
So, you know, it's not like I can, there's an open job, there's a great job market in short fiction, say, oh yeah, someone will leave and I can get their job. You know, there just aren't that many.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, there are, you know, I, as an author trying to get in, you know, I definitely, you know, lament. I guess in one way you just look and say there are tons of markets out there, but I guess, you know, on the scale of sci fiction, there's really almost nothing. I mean, there are a few. I mean, I had John Joseph Adams on the show recently from Magazine of Fantasy and Science Fiction, so they're there. Mm-hmm. But you're right, there's a fistful, really.
Yeah, and they're not looking for short. They're not looking for editors.
Right.
I mean, in the past, I actually was offered the various jobs at different magazines that are professional magazines, but at the time, I still had the job at Omni, so I wasn't interested.
Right.
You know, when the editors left. So, I mean, I don't see that's never going to happen with Gordon. I mean, Gordon Van Gelder, the owner and publisher of FNSF. I don't think it's going to happen again with Asimov, and I certainly don't think I'd be right for Analog. And those are the three major magazines. Rumble Fantasy, it's only a part-time gig anyway, you know, but I don't think Shauna's going to leave, Shauna McCarthy.
Right.
You know, I mean, it's just that there isn't anything out there, which is why there is an open market on anthologies, and I can hopefully sell more.
Sure.
And do good ones. You know, well, I mean, I don't want to overextend myself. I don't want to... You know, when I was doing anthologies and editing sci fiction and putting out a story every week, I had to pace myself. I couldn't do that many anthologies because it was just too much work with the steady gig. But because if I only do anthologies, then I could take on some more and I wouldn't feel uncomfortable about that at all. And not only that, but I'm doing science fiction, fantasy, and horror anthologies, which is great.
Okay.
And I love switching around.
Well, definitely feel free to go ahead and plug, you know, your major releases that are coming out this year.
Oh, okay. Well, one book has just been, it's a bind-up. It's, all right, Terry Winling and I did two children's fairy tale books for Simon & Schuster. They're called A Wolf at the Door and Swan Sister. Simon & Schuster has repackaged them for sale only at Barnes & Noble. It's called The Dark of the Woods. It's in a little hardcover. It's $7.95. It's in the bookstores now. And it's like this nice little, I guess, 70,000-word children's anthology now of fairy tales, retold fairy tales. And I saw the cover. It's got a new cover by Charles Vess, and it looks very good. But as I said, it's only available in Barnes & Noble. Year's Best number 19 is coming out in August in St. Martin's, and it's got a new cover. I hope it's not going to offend all the Tom Canty people who love Tom's covers. He's done this cover, too. He's designed it and created it, but it is not at all his usual style. It's completely different from the first 18 years, so I don't know how people are going to react.
Okay.
And also another book, Terry Winling and I co-edited Salon Fantastique, which was a non-theme fantasy anthology for Thunder's Mouth Press. That was kind of a rush. We thought that, we didn't realize it was coming out this early, but it's coming out in like September, October. And that's, I think it's about 110,000 words. You know, and it's good. It's a good book. I mean, I didn't get everybody. There were a few people who were supposed to write stories and I didn't finish them in time, so I'm kind of disappointed. But we have some excellent work by Gregory Maguire and Delia Sherman and Jeffrey Ford and Rick Bowes and Greg Gilman. So, you know, I think it's a good anthology. So that's what's coming out this year, and then I'll have, like, I have at least two coming out next year, maybe three.
Okay.
Oh, yeah, The Coyote Road. Well, The Coyote Road is the one that Terry Winling and I, it's the third in our kind of a myth series, our YA series for Viking, and that'll be coming out in 07.
Okay, and that's that you said that's YA myth, the young adult myth.
That's YA crossover with adults. It's from the series of The Green Man and The Fairy Real, and Coyote Road is Trickster Tales.
Oh, gotcha, okay.
And it's illustrated by Charles Vess, as the other two have been, with a Charles Vess cover.
All right, well, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be right back with Ellen Datlow. But first, let's do some earbuds with Andrea from Chicago, a.k.a. Andrea Smarty Hottie.
Jack Magnet's Deadpan. Earbuds.
Hey, Deadpan, this is Andrea. I am creeping down I-55 towards the city of Chicago after work, and thought I would call and do an earbud. Let's see. This week I've been listening to a lot of industrial music because I saw two really good industrial bands play this weekend. I saw Nine Inch Nails and Bauhaus open for them, and I saw a band called Diary of Dreams, which is a really cool gothic industrial band from Germany with a really, really cute singer. And not that that matters. That doesn't really add anything to the music, but thought I'd, you know, add that. So I've been playing a lot of Nine Inch Nails, a lot of Ministry, and a lot of Diary of Dreams, and another couple of bands that are also kind of obscure German industrial bands, Project Pitchfork, and VNV Nation. Other than that, I checked the old iTunes today, and there was a few cool things. There was a new Frank Black, which I picked up. It's a little different. I only listened to a little bit of it, but it looks kind of cool. There was also, they had a couple really cool compilations. They had like a compilation of Latin music, traditional Latin music, that looked really cool. I might have to go back and get that. They had, what else did they have? I'm drawing a complete blank now. Crap. Okay, well, I guess that's all I'm giving you for today, because I am drawing a total blank. So, have a good day. Bye.
Jack Mangan's Deadpan. The coolest thing to hit your computer since you spilled that cold soda last week.
Now, I'm going to touch on something you said a little while ago, how Sci-Fi basically approached you with just the idea then of this magazine. So that was basically, Sci-Fiction then was basically created for you.
Uh-huh, yeah. We had no name. It was Craig Engler and Sean Redlitz approached me. We had been talking for ages. They would come to conventions and I'd talk to them. And they originally mentioned it when I think I was still at Omni, or maybe when we just started doing Event Horizon. But nothing happened for a year and a half, which is why I would never hold my breath for someone to give me a job, you know.
Okay.
But just a year and a half later, they said, well, we want to do it. You ready? You know, I said, yeah. So we had to put together an idea of how we were going to do it. We had to come up with the title, you know, with Sci-Fiction as a name. Mm-hmm. We wanted to have something to do with Sci-Fi Channel, so we had to, you know, we wanted to try to use that, the name to expand, you know. We wanted to have the name go with the channel's name. And figured out what we would do, how much I had to spend, and basically that was it. You know, I hired a copy editor. I mean, actually, over the years, I had one copy editor and proofreader, and they changed over the years. And I have a slush reader,
mm-hmm.
and most everything was done. I had a producer. The producer did all the. He put up the stories, and he designed the stories. We used to have different art, and then it changed. We used to get an artist to do the art every week. And then the last year or so, we'd save money by reusing some of the art at a certain point.
Okay.
I mean, it wasn't art specific to the stories. It was just kind of, it was interesting abstract art that someone designed for us. So, and I worked from home. It was great. You know, and I was able to edit everything. The copy edit came by email. So, I mean, there's a lot of it. A lot of this, even if it wasn't web-based, email and just electronic media has made editing, the whole editing process quicker, you know, back and forth with the authors.
Right. I know there was a lot of grumbling from authors, and I know there was a lot of discussion about electronic submissions. Do you think that that's something you would ever entertain at any time in the future?
And no. because I'm not going to print them out. I mean, I'm actually judging the Chai Zine contest right now, and I'm getting them all the submissions by email. I would never do it again. I mean, this is fine. I'm doing it this once. The stories are really short, but I want submissions in print. You know, it's just easier to read them.
And it's easier to keep track of them. That's even more important. You know, if it, as I, you know, when people want to send me things, they'll say, well, you know, if I don't have it on, if I don't have pieces of paper that are lying around the house, it means it'll be on my computer someplace and I'll forget to go back to it.
Okay. Yeah, yeah, I mean, after, right, after you've established your style after all these years, that's certainly understandable. Now, over all these years of playing such an influential role, I mean, all these years of being an influential woman, what do you think, what's your take on that and what's your experience been as just being, you know, a woman in a field where, you know, maybe 40 or 50 years ago, or maybe you even had to deal with, you know, guys with male writers kind of treating it like a boys club and like, you know, where...
I've never had that trouble. I mean, there are people who were resentful when I got the job at Omni, but I don't think it was because I was a woman. It was because I came out of nowhere. They had no idea who I was, and I wasn't out of fandom. So, like, here I am, the stranger coming out of science fiction, and even though I had, I know there was some resentment when I was, after I was the associate fiction editor for about a year and a half or 2 years or whatever, and Bob Sheckley left, and I was appointed fiction editor, there was some resentment there that people didn't approach these are guys, you know, and say, well, you know, you should be the fiction editor. There was that kind of resentment. When I got into editing Omni, Shauna McCarthy was working with Asimov, Susan Allison, Beth Meacham. There were plenty of female editors in the book field and in magazines at the time. Mm-hmm. Not plenty, but certainly I didn't feel overwhelmingly dominated, but I didn't feel the field was dominated by male editors, for sure. As far as writers, I think in the late 80s, I mean, I actually checked this out, because people were always saying that the Nebulas and Yugas were always dominated by males.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I checked, I forget when it was, I'd have to go back to my notes, but in the late 80s or mid-90s, the ballot was dominated by, the short story area was dominated by women. Nancy Kress, Octavia Butler, Connie Willis especially, Elizabeth Scarborough, I think her name is. I mean, there were a lot of writers who were on the ballot who were female. And frankly, when I read, I'm gender blind. I certainly don't go out of my way to publish more women than men, or more men than women. I mean, it turns out that in a lot of my horror anthologies, I publish more men than women.
Mm-hmm.
In science fiction, the first 3 years, I published more men than women. In 1 6-month period, I ended up publishing a lot of women. But, I mean, it was just happenstance. I don't plan it. I never did plan it that way. And I don't read that way.
Sure, yeah. I don't think any serious editor ever could limit themselves in any way, any, you know, simple-minded way like that. Yeah.
I think in a way I feel responsible, and I'm not sure it's such a great thing. I mean, I've always been for mixing the genres, and I'm very happy about mixing the genres. And currently, I think there's a lot of genre slop over between science fiction and fantasy. And that can be a wonderful thing, and I've been pushing it a lot throughout my career. And now sometimes it worries me because I think that it can also create a blandness. If it, you know, and people complain that things are not genre anymore. There's not enough in the genre. There's not enough science fiction. And I agree that a lot more people are writing fantasy short fiction than science fiction short fiction right now. And that bothers me. I mean, I and every other short story editor I know is looking for more science fiction.
Okay,
I feel responsible for what's happened by pushing, by encouraging that slop over, you know, between science fiction and fantasy.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm always of the mindset, right, that when you're willing to fuse elements, that, you know, good stuff is going to come out of it. I mean, I definitely see your argument against on the other side, but. I think only good things will come of that, even if we're in a bland period right now.
I mean, I think there's wonderful work being published. I mean, I love a lot of the short stories being published. I love Kelly Link's work, Margot Lanigan. Jeffrey Ford is incredible. Every story he writes is different. In horror, Joe Hill is doing amazing short work. I publish a lot of Australians, Lucy Sussex, Terry Dowling. And in England, there are a whole bunch of wonderful short story writers in England. Stephen Gallagher, Joel Lane, Michael Marshall Smith, who isn't writing as many short stories as I'd love him to write. Peter Crowther writes really good short fiction. You know, I mean, there are plenty of good short story writers there who are writing science fiction, fantasy, and horror, but not enough writing science fiction. I'm not even talking about hard science fiction. Maureen McHugh writes very good science fiction.
Right.
You know, so I mean, you know, I can, you know, any time I'll make one argument, like, it pops out of the other way. Wait a minute, I can say, I can name like 10 writers who are doing the exact opposite. So.
Right.
I can make an argument either way. What can I say?
Now, speaking of this, now you, I guess this ties everything together we've been talking about, is that you have one of your cool gigs coming up, and maybe it's going to help create some more great sci-fi writers, is you're teaching Clarion this summer, is that right?
Yes, I am. I do it about every 5 years they get me to do it.
Okay.
The one in Seattle. I also taught in Australia a year and a half ago.
Okay.
And I met some really good, very, very good science fiction and fantasy and horror writers there from that class. In Australia, the class, it seems it's a smaller pool. I think that most of the writers actually are more professional or have some sales already under their belts, even not if they're professional sales, than American writers.
Okay.
At least at the Clarion South that I attended. But yeah, I'm teaching Clarion West, and this will be my fourth time, I think, teaching Clarion West.
Okay. Well,
which is Seattle. Yeah.
Right. Okay. And now, well, I guess maybe if we, we'll probably wrap it up here, but I guess maybe if we can wrap it up with a little bit of your thoughts and advice for new writers. Give us a quick sample of what those writers will get for free, of course.
Of course. let's see. Now you're really putting me on the spot. Let me think. Oh, boy.
Sorry.
Well, first of all, writers should rewrite, but there's a time to finish rewriting and you have to send the stories out. I think the most important thing is you send a story out, you don't sit and wait to get a response, you write your next story. As soon as you finish one story, you write another story. You can always go back to the first one and rewrite it. But people who are waiting for a response, like for 6 months, and then don't write anything in that time, that's crazy. I mean, you're not going to be a writer that way.
Sure.
The thing about Clarion is a lot of people end up not being writers, not continuing, not writing after they get out of Clarion, and that's a good thing, too. It can show you, well, it'll either give you good work habits, and it can also show you whether you want to be a writer or not. You may think you want to be, and then if you go to Clarion for 6 weeks and you can't hack it, or you may just not be able to like, you may not like the structure of Clarion also, but it can help you make a decision as to, do I really want to write or not, or do I want to do something else?
Okay.
But I mean, when I teach Clarion, it's mostly it's workshopping a lot of the stuff, and what I'll always do as an editor, I come in the fifth week, and I'll try to look at everything from an editorial point of view, and I'll give them marketing tips, but also this is how you behave. I try to give, like, this is what you do. This is a process. This is good behavior. Once you sell a story, you know, this is how you can act with the editor. You meet the editor, blah, blah, blah. You know, just useful, hopefully useful things that they can just, you know, in the real world, that the writers can... The writers have some clue as to how to deal with editors in the real world if they meet them.
Sure.
You know, and what not to do. I used to do that more. When more editors had expense accounts, I haven't had an expense account in a while,
okay.
But when more editors had expense accounts, you know, I would say, okay, once you sell them a story and if they invite you to a meal, then probably they're going to pay for you, but you can't bring anyone with you, that kind of stuff. But now that I don't have an expense account and a lot of other people I know don't, it's a whole different ball game. So I can't tell them that.
Okay.
I can give them a variation of it.
I actually always noticed in the years, submitting short fiction, all around all sorts of different markets, it always struck me that just the professionalism, but yet also you're just very friendly and approachable too. So it's, you know,
good. I hate to think. I know some people. I hear that some people are intimidated by me, and that really appalls me. But I've also been told that I write the nicest rejection letters in the field, so I'm very happy. I'm very proud of that.
Yeah, you were very nice. I received a few of those over the years, and they're always very uplifting.
I mean, I try to be honest, and if I have something that I think can help the writer, I'll say it. But if I don't, I'm not going to, you know, I don't give criticism just for the sake of criticism. It's only if I think that something can help the story, help the writer sell the story and make it better.
Sure. Okay. Well, I guess we can wrap up there. Thank you very much for taking the half an hour or so to do this interview, Ellen, and best of luck to you.
You're very welcome. It's been a pleasure.
Yeah, I've definitely enjoyed it, and thank you for coming on the Deadpan.
Jack Magnet's Deadpan. Earbuds.
Hey, Deadpan, it's Andrea again. As soon as I hung up, my brain started working again. The other really cool compilation was called Femme Fatale, and it was women in electronic music, like the top women in electronic music, and it was really, really, really good. There was one lady on there named Andrea, so, you know. Of course, I'm sure she's awesome. And let's see what else. The other thing was Peaches. Peaches was another band that opened for Nine Inch Nails. I really didn't care for them, but they had a new EP. I don't know if people might like them. And I believe that was it. Oh, well, Jessica Simpson has a new single out. For anyone that cares. I'm sure anybody made fun of for that on the comment board. So go ahead and make fun of me. All right, bye.
Available now. Get the soundtrack to The Magical Mystery Trick featuring Lady Uhura, the Ballad of Khan and Yoko. She came in through the holodeck window. Hey, Spock, Nurse Chapel Rigby, everybody's got something to hide except for me and my tribble. Being for the benefit of Mr. Sulu, when I was 64, happiness and a warm phaser. Oh, Black Dick, oh, Black Doc. The Sulu on the hill, with a little help from my Ferengis. Mean Mr. Chekhov. Lucy in the sky with dilithium crystals. Day Transporter. Maxwell's Silver Phaser and many, many more. This collection is not available in stores. Just $19.67 for 4 records, 2 cassettes, 3 8-tracks, 5 CDs, 3 DAT tapes, 10 reel-to-reels, 7 phonograph cylinders, 20 megabytes of MP3s, 6 laser discs, 4 VHS tapes, 4 Betamax tapes, 5 DVDs. All right, Jack. It's in every format. We get it, okay? Jack mauled her, a man's man, and yet no man's man, but always his own man. He kicks asses and takes names, mostly of extraterrestrials, what he likes to call extra tees, and knows all the motel night clerks. Hard drinking, warrior poet. A man with a past, our hero and guide through the Ex-Wife Files. You can find the Ex-Wife Files at patiobooks.com.
Okay, I've come to a decision. Next week's show is going to be another interview-free show. I've actually gotten backed up on content. I have so much stuff that we're out of time to play. I have stolen rap lyrics from Mark Forman, who you just heard do a masterful performance as our KTEL Records-esque commercial announcer. Thank you very much, Blues Man. And also Danny from NC has some great stolen rap lyrics that we're going to have to wait on. So hey, the call is always open. If you want to record something and send it in, fine. Or if you'd rather just send it to voicemail, the voicemail line is 206-350-TOMI. Speaking of Tomi, You may have seen at jackmangan.com, the print version of Spherical Tomy is set to come out next week. So keep checking www.jackmangan.com for more information about that. I'll be updating as I learn new information. So thank you for listening to Deadpan. We're going to leave off this week with something called Soldier Boy Jam. Now, Soldier Boy is an 8-minute Matt Mango tune. Matt Mango and Steve Fernandez and I recorded for the Wishing Bridge CD. But when I was going around to places to play live in the Valley, I put together this CD of, you know, just kind of focusing on my guitar playing. So what I did was I took the Soldier Boy and chopped it down to about 3-4 minutes of the solos. And thus Soldier Boy Jam was born. What's cool about this is it's Matt Mango on rhythm guitar, Steve Fernandez on drums, me on bass, me on lead guitar 1, and me on lead guitar 2. Now, I'm definitely going to play the full version of Soldier Boy in a future Deadpan, but for this week, enjoy Soldier Boy Jam. And that's it. Stay tuned to the website, feel free to post comments, and more information forthcoming about the Spherical Tomy print book. Keep it Deadpan. Thank you.
changing more.